I'm going to take this chance to set aside God, other worlds, and the Vedas. I'm going to make these theologians look foolish, and when I'm finished, the king will listen to me instead. He'll forget about all this religious babble, and he'll focus instead on making the kingdom rich and prosperous. These are the words of Vridumbi, who is the real villain of Much Ado About Religion. If you haven't listened to the first part of this episode, go back and do that now, since we first met our villain 2 weeks ago, just at the end of that episode. He is about to debate our hero, Sankarsana, and a Shaivite theologian known only as the Abbot. But as we left things at the end of our last episode, we weren't sure whether Sankarsana would join forces with the Shaivite Abbot, since they have some pretty deep disagreements. But if he doesn't join forces, the kingdom may be at stake.
I'm Malcolm Keating, and you're listening to Sutras and Stuff.
Vridumbi is a Charvakin, which means he's a materialist and he doesn't believe in the existence of gods, souls, or other kinds of invisible things. And he also thinks that perception is the only way of knowing. He just trusts his senses. And he's suspicious and cynical about organized religion. So he charges right into debate with the abbot, asserting that God doesn't exist. In this verse, which is very famous, he says, "There goes the son of a barren woman, fresh from bathing in the water of a mirage, a wreath of sky flowers on his head, holding a bow made of rabbit horn." So these images are all common examples of non-existing objects, impossible objects even. Vridumbi has basically just compared God to Superman or Santa Claus, and he's just getting started. As he lays out his argument against the existence of God and against the rationality of religious practices, Vridumbi insults the abbot. He calls him an idiot, a blind person, and throughout it, he smiles contemptuously. So right out of the gate, he's broken the rules that we heard about in our last episode. His debating style is to insult while arguing, to make rude faces, and to criticize rather than to present his own views. In an important sense, he's not engaging in truth-seeking debate, which is the kind that our Nyaya philosophers think is how we can come to know difficult things through conversation. Given that he's basically breaking the rules of truth-seeking debate in order to castigate the Vedas, the other world, and God, one of the Nyaya philosophers we've heard about in some earlier episodes, Vachaspati Mishra, would say, "Well, look, good debaters are justified in using fallacies to upstage him. This is an emergency situation, and it calls for emergency measures." However, in Jayantabhatta's play, the abbot doesn't resort to these strategies. Instead, he argues that we can infer the existence of God. When there's an effect, there has to be a cause, and the world is a kind of effect which requires a very special and very powerful cause, and that cause is God. Of course, Vridumbi wouldn't be very impressed with inference, since he thinks just perception is a reliable way to know. I mean, think about it. Just because we've seen two things occur together in the past, that doesn't guarantee they're going to happen together in the future. But the abbot pivots. He wants to show Vridumbi that he has to accept inference. Otherwise, how can he know there is some way of knowing called perception? After all, Vridumbi, you can't see perception, says the abbot, but you have to infer it. And you infer it from the fact that we have experiences of things like colors when our eyes are looking at objects. Once Vridumbi accepts this and the door is cracked open a little bit for inference, then the abbot argues we can infer the existence of God. At this point, our initially arrogant Charvakin stops responding to the abbot and instead draws on the ground, sulking. Eventually, he gets up to leave, but the abbot stands in his way. He says, "Not so fast. There's another way to know that God exists, and that's scripture." Then, just like he was in a wrestling match and he was taking turns, he tags the graduate, and the graduate picks up the argument. This is an important moment in the play, so let's pause for a moment. The abbot is a Shaivite, as we've said, and he believes in a personal God who has revealed a set of scriptures that our graduate Sankarsana, a Mimamsa scholar, rejects. As a very loose approximation, we could compare the abbot and Sankarsana to a Christian and a Jew who are part of a broadly shared tradition, but one accepts a new revelation and the other doesn't. However, that comparison only goes so far since there's an even deeper difference between them. Sankarsana doesn't think that Vedic scripture, which he and the abbot both accept, is authored by a divine being at all. Instead, he thinks it has no beginning in time. And this, in fact, is why it is such a powerful authority. When we talked about testimony in episode 4, we noted that testimony depends on a person who has knowledge. But for Mimamsa philosophers, Vedic testimony is a special case where there's no person testifying who could be wrong. It's almost like the code on which the universe runs, and that code has simply just always existed. So when Sankarsana agrees to debate with Vridambi, it's because he and the abbot have decided to set this private quarrel about the origin of scriptures aside, and instead they've focused on what they share, which is the belief in the Vedas and in their being authoritative, whether or not it was authored by a divine being. As you might expect, Sankarsana defeats Vridambi handily in the debate, and he's reduced to yet more silent sulking. The kingdom is safe from materialists, at least for the moment. But there's still a problem. The religious groups who trace themselves in some way to the Vedas are still at odds. And the Jains and the Buddhists, well, they're still being allowed to live in the kingdom, even though the black blankets are not and have been chased out. So how can the king justify his treatment of these religious groups? How can he satisfy them? Well, he does what any good ruler does when faced with a challenge. He holds a committee meeting. So it's at the committee meeting of religious leaders that we meet the text's real hero. You see, Sankarsana has done important work, but he doesn't know the answer to this question of how to satisfy all these different religious groups. He's a Mimamsa scholar, and he's convinced that his view is correct. As he watches the other scholars assemble, he wonders to himself, "I wonder how I should behave among these people, for they adhere to the guidance and instructions of diverse, mutually contradictory scholarly works." At that point then, he takes refuge in Vishnu. After his prayers, he joins the committee meeting, where the king has requested Dhairyarashi to speak. Dhairyarashi is a Nyaya philosopher, and he has the solution. Rather than engage in debate, however, he just takes the floor and speaks without interruption, to explain what the king and the theologians should do. His speech does not begin with a call to religious tolerance. It begins by criticizing Mimamsa theories about religious scriptures. And this seems like a pretty poor start, since he's not going to make Sankarsana and the other Mimamsa philosophers happy. As a Nyaya philosopher, he thinks that the Vedas are divinely authored. And for him, this isn't just an incidental fact about the Vedas. It is key to explaining these different religious traditions. Here's what he says about God. "Though he is one, since he takes on a variety of bodies according to his desire, and he teaches all kinds of scriptures for the benefit of all beings, he has many names. Shiva, Pashupati, Kapila, and Vishnu, the divine Sankarsana," and here, by the way, he's not talking about our Mimamsa scholar, but he's talking about the king of the Nagas, or the serpents, "the sage Jinna, who is the founder of the Jains, and the Buddha, and Manu are all one. Only the designations differ, and, well, maybe their bodies as well, but there is no plurality in the undifferentiated supreme self." So this is what he says, and it isn't just that there are different manifestations of God, but these manifestations fit different human beings and their goals. And here's something that even the conservative Mimamsakas can appreciate. For Mimamsakas resolve apparent contradictions in Vedic scriptures by focusing on who the scriptural commands are for. Dhairyarashi says the same thing applies here. We have different salvific paths for different people, but the goal is the same: deliverance from rebirth. Now, this seems like a pretty good approach. It gives legitimacy to everyone, and it also allows for genuine difference. However, we might think that Sankarsana isn't going to be very happy with a justification of religious pluralism that depends on rejecting his favorite theological thesis. So Dhairyarashi gives a slightly different version. In this version, some of the newer religious scriptures are also unauthored. But what happens is that their supposed authors are just mediators of something that pre-exists them. So this is throwing a bit of a bone to our Mimamsaka friends. In his speech, though, Tyagarashi has to explain not just the existence of these different scriptural traditions, but also how people identify in their practices. Conservative Mimamsa theologians, for instance, are upset that other people are calling themselves Brahmins and they're calling their new scriptures Vedas. Like we heard in episode 8, Nyaya philosophers have a lot to say about how to understand generic terms like doctor, and how they're used in broad and in more specialized senses. Tyagarashi says we shouldn't worry too much about things like what castes, like being a Brahmin, are, and how we can know and who is in what caste and so on. Instead, the focus should be on maintaining society as it is, and ensuring that different religious groups do not criticize each other. To make an analogy with another set of religious traditions, Tyagarashi might have said to John Calvin, Martin Luther, and Joseph Smith, "Hey guys, don't worry about what the word Christian means and who counts as a Christian. Just stop insulting each other and let everyone alone to their own religious practices." But, you might say, Tyagarashi has forgotten about the Buddhists, the Jains, and what about Muslims, Sufis, Christian Scientists, Unitarian Universalists? Should we throw Scientologists and QAnon in here for good measure? The Church of Satan, the Branch Davidians? If Tyagarashi is right that God takes on many manifestations, does that mean that everybody's religion is a manifestation of God and equally acceptable? Well, in his context, of course, he hasn't forgotten the Buddhists. He says that they've been around for a long time, just like Brahmins. And for those who might criticize the Buddhists, criticizing them for not being a religion won't cut it. So remember Sankarsana flippantly saying that the Buddhists were just out to make money? Well, Tyagarashi says, look, this criticism can apply to the Brahmins, who make their living from Vedic ritual as well. So religious practitioners should be careful. They're not immune to the criticisms they make of other groups. And there's really no way to definitively settle these deep metaphysical questions in a way that's going to make everyone happy. And there's not even a way to exclude religions on the basis of being for-profit institutions. So this means that for the king and the people running the government, they should accept all religious scriptures as authoritative. If you're wondering what this means for the Black Blankets and our Charvakan villain, well, Tyagarashi gives a list of criteria which he thinks will help rulers draw the line. Tolerable religions, from the state's point of view, are those which have a long tradition that everybody knows about. They're ones that don't cause Aryan people to be offended. They're ones which aren't a danger to society. They're ones which are not inspired by an insane person. And they're ones which aren't focused only on material wealth, but they have to have some spiritual aspect. Tyagarashi then concludes that his list excludes religions that obligate people to eat impure things and to have sex. Clearly, he says, these would be offensive, gross practices. At the end of his speech, everyone agrees that Tyagarashi, the Nyaya philosopher, is brilliant. The committee concludes that these criteria will work, and Sankarsana adds that religions need to stay in their own lanes. We should be careful not to intermix, and everyone should stay within their own religion. Thus, we have what seems to be a happy ending. For everyone except the Black Blankets and the Charvakans, of course. The play presents them as dangerous to society and to be rightly shunned. But after spending an entire season listening to some aspects of Nyaya philosophy, we might wonder about some internal tensions here. Tyagarashi hasn't argued for the negative effects of these different religions. He simply assumed that everybody knows they exist and what they are. But in Nyaya terms, if we want to know that an action has a negative effect, we need to use our ways of knowing, our pramanas. And cause and effect relationships are really difficult, as we've already seen. What evidence does he have, for instance, that eating certain foods will have a bad effect on human society? What kind of bad effect is it? Now, Tyagarashi might say that scriptures are evidence, and scriptures are a way of knowing, as he's argued. But remember, there are lots of things that scriptures conflict about, and what foods are able to be eaten is one of those points of conflict. Jain theologians, for instance, will criticize Brahminical theologians for eating living creatures. And there's another criterion that's worth reflecting on in light of Nyaya commitments, and that's the idea of being offended. In Sanskrit, vimukha, having one's face turned away. Tyagarashi seems to think that offense is either a reason to exclude a religion, or maybe it's a sign of something being wrong with the religion. Now, The problem with taking mere offense as a reason to exclude a religion is it could have the very fault Daivarashi wants to avoid with his set of criteria. It's called overextension. In other words, if we take this as a reason, it might apply to too many things. A mimamsaka with an overly sensitive set of scruples might be offended or repulsed by a Shaivite's religion, for instance. So just any individual person's offense seems like it's not enough of a reason. But maybe if somebody is offended, that's a sign of the religion being bad, just like smoke is a sign of fire. Well, as a good Nyaya philosopher, Daivarashi needs to show that this relationship holds. And then we're back to where we started, investigating the relationship between religions and their effects. We began season 2 with the observation that Nyaya philosophers are concerned with the fundamentals of human life. They want to achieve fundamental spiritual peace. As we arrive at the end of the season, we see that they're concerned with this not just at the level of individual human beings, but at the level of society as a whole. Achieving this kind of peace is not an easy task. It involves fine-tuning our skills as knowers and our ability to reason with other people. As a result, hopefully, we move individually and collectively just a little bit closer towards the truth. Now, we modern people may disagree with some of the Nyaya conclusions about religious tolerance and the boundaries of society, but it isn't as if our modern societies have achieved complete religious harmony either. So we may yet have lessons to learn from Nyaya philosophers, even across the many centuries that separate us.